took the it's the Ashkenazi Jew. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, 546. Okay, I wanted to miss the Yud base. 546, going out to miss the Yud base. Hillel the Shammai Kibu Mehem. Hillel the Shammai received the tradition. Everybody see it. 546, bottom, Mishnah, last Mishnah on the page. Hillel the Shammai Kibu Mehem. Hillel Omer, having me Tabido Shel Aaron, be a disciple of Aaron. Ohev Shalom, Verodek Shalom, be a lover of peace, and a chaser of, a pursuer of peace. Oh, if it's, see that, 546, if it's in the Nusach Ashkenaz here. Oh, if it's a Brios of a Kovan Latorah, be a lover of peace and a pursuer of peace. Love the Brios and draw them near to Torah. Now, the first thing that Hillel and Shammai say, Hillel, we're going to say this is only Hillel. Hillel says, be a disciple of Aaron. Aaron was the proverbial peace lover. Aaron was the one who went around making peace among people in Klai Tzav. And when two people were fighting, Aaron would go from one to the other, and he would say, well, listen, he's upset with you, and he would try to make peace. He would also make peace between husbands and wives. The Gemara says that there's a medrash that says that there were husbands and wives that were having problems, and Aaron made peace among them, and there were 18,000 children in Klai Tzav. I think there were 12,000 or 18,000 children in Klai Tzav that were born to parents who would otherwise have split up had Aaron not made peace between them. And the firstborn son, after he managed to keep the marriage together, they all named Aaron after him. So there's a lot of children named Aaron. And so nowadays, like Josh, right? In the old days, it was Aaron, right? And there were a lot of kids named Aaron in Klai Tzav because Aaron was the one who managed to maintain peace between them. I always wonder about the Cheder Rebbe. You know, when he got 9 kids in the class named Aaron, exactly how the Rebbe called on one of the kids. That's what the Medrash says.
They named it after him
in honor of him, not after him. In honor of him. What's that? Sephardim do. Ashkenazim generally do not name after in honor of people who are alive. Sephardim do. Sephardim will sometimes, there are Sephardim who even name kids after their father. In honor of the father, often for sure after grandparents who are alive. Right? Ashkenazim generally don't. Ashkenazim generally wait till. It's one of the sources, by the way, it's one of the greatest sources of conflict when children are born, is fighting over names. And not only that, there are sources that say that if parents fight over the name of the child, then the child's life is in danger. Right? And the best policy is just to say to your wife that name her whatever she wants. Right? And then, well, generally, that's the way that the first one, she generally gets to choose, unless you don't like it. But generally, she gets to choose it. And then it's a good thing, you know, you alter it, but it's also a good thing you'll know when you're young and creative, so then people get ideas like naming after, you know, all sorts of exotic names. You know, the name the kid Tangerine or something, you know, whatever. all sorts of names, you know, something young, new and creative. A guy just called me up recently, he wanted to name his kid. He called me right from Clipboard, he said, they have a child, and they wanted to name the kid, they wanted to give the kid a name, his wife doesn't like the name. So I said to him, what is the name? So I don't want to say what it was in case they ever meet the guy one day, but it was along the lines of, he said he was a Kriyas HaTorah on Shabbos, this part is true, he was in Shulzing and Shul on Shabbos, and then during Kriyas HaTorah, and he really liked the idea, somehow he got really inspired, he wanted to name the kid, it comes out to something like Vayomer Hashem, like, and he wanted to get like Vayomer Hashem El Moshe, I wanted to name the kid, so I tried to explain the guy on the phone, We give our children names. We don't give them themes. You know, the kid is not going to be an idea. The kid is going to have an identity. And I said to him, your wife is 100% right. Apologize and just give him a normal name, right? You know, but there is a lot of fighting. You should never fight over the name. You should generally work it out. And it is a good policy right from the early on to name after deceased relatives, because down the line you're going to also want to be named after. And it just keeps everybody happy. There could still be fighting because sometimes, you know, there's a meddling aunt who would like her uncle to be named after her father, to be named after her. So it's never easy. But in general, you should certainly defer to your wife and try to reach a irritability. Anything she doesn't like, there's one of the things I told the guy. The guy wants a name. I said to the guy before you even tell me the name. Just tell me the argument. I'll tell you what I think, because objectively, you know, maybe I don't like the name myself. So before you even tell me the name, I would tell you that if your wife doesn't like it, so just choose another name she does. It's not the only name you like. And if it's a name she does like, she's got to raise the kid. You know, if she's going to feed the kid and everything. And then he told me the name, and I was horrified. You know, when I said the name, I said, you got to they got to lock you up. They got to put you away. And he was laughing, but it was ridiculous. So I know one guy who added a name. I think he added the name his wife wanted a certain name, and at the bris, he just called an audible at the line of scrimmage, right? At the bris, he added the name Clonimus to his child, right? You know, and his wife was saying that, he creation mobi Israel, David Clonimus Ben Chaim. And his wife was like sitting there, she's looking like, what? You know, now every time she's got to look at this kid, this is a Clonimus in front of her. Yeah, she just wasn't happy. You can't get good calling audibles. You got to make that up before you get to the line.
Rather, what does the name Osnat mean?
The name Osnat was a daughter of the adopted daughter of Potiphar, who ended up marrying Yosef. What the name means, I don't know. What the name means, I don't know. But there also, I know a girl, I know of the case, Rabbi Zwei told me, he has a girl who is named Achzava, which means disappointment, right? That is not a name. But then somebody told me in America, a girl that was the parents named her Nemesis. Right, that was the name, right? This is not names that you would want to give, right? Now, they also have to be careful that the name should be a traditional Jewish name. Since we don't know Greek, we only have the American interpretation. So they got Nemesis, hey Nemesis, better. Now, I heard of a brisk this week, the guy had twins this week in Eretz Yisrael, and Thursday was the Chazanisha's Yortzeit. And Friday was Rosh Chach's Yortzeit. They had twins, they're born this week, so they named one Avraham Yishai, and they named one Elohim Menachemite. Right? That's a lot better than Nemesis. Now, we could expect to see more from them. Now, so it says like this, Have a meet Talmidim to Aaron, Oev Shalom V'Rodishom. You got a lover of peace and a chaser of peace. Oev Esabrias, you got to love people, Makarvan LaTorah, and draw them near to Torah. Now, he gives us here two very important keys. One is the key to becoming a peacemaker, and the other is the key to drawing people near to Torah. The key to being a peacemaker is that you have to love shalom. And I say shalom, shalom means peace, well-being. Please, over that window if we get there. There's got to be a certain love of peace. We are not raised in a society. If you were, I hate to step on anybody's toes, but if you're ever in shul, davening, and all of a sudden there's some yelling coming from, all of a sudden a couple of old guys are going at it, usually over a seat. They're yelling at each other. Or somebody's upset with the gabbai because he forgot he had a yortzeit or something. There's some arguing going on. It's always fun. If anything is better than Sukkot Zimra, it breaks up the monotony in shul. When something good happens, now it was worth coming to shul on Shabbat. Shul is kind of, say the words, say the pages. When there's a bit of a scuffle, right? That makes things a lot more. In case I missed it there, I wasn't there in the shul. I'd already left the shul. But there was a show where a guy was in the middle of davening, and I was really I missed this. I was upset, In the middle of davening, there were two guys were talking. The guy sitting in a row in front of them. He turned around and went shh. Right? The guy's just the guy kept on talking. He just turned around. And he clocked the guy behind. Right in the middle. He just roundhouse the guy, knocked him out. And I missed it. When I was a kid, I'd come home from shul, and every Shabbos my mom would say, "So what happened in shul?" So I started saying, "Well, somebody got punched, mom. I mean, what could have happened in shul? They landed, there were Ali. In the 1 week that somebody got punched, I wasn't there." But the shul was really quiet for us leaning after that. That's the best way. Have the gabbai take two guys out, and then nobody talks. Now, the reason I bring this up is, because you ever see, let's say you're in a lunchroom. Let's say you're in a lunchroom here. You sit there eating lunch. All of a sudden, two guys start, there's a bit of a shove. Right? Two guys are, they're talking, and there's a bit of a shove. All of a sudden, a third guy gets in between and starts breaking them up. What's going on in your heart of hearts, and maybe not so much in your heart of hearts, maybe it's a little close. What's really going up when that third guy steps in there?
You
wish
you would have broken up. You
what?
You wish
you would have
broken up.
Of course. You guys have to say, hey, get out of there, will you? Let's see some action around here. Kind of boring learning Bubba Bazzer all day. Let's see some action. In your heart of hearts, you're not that upset about it. If you see a scuffle, you want to see some fists thrown. That means that you've got some asav in you. And I say you because it's really me. That means that we have asav in us. That's not a big, if you could watch the Gulf War, while the Gulf War is going on, and you're watching planes taking out buildings, and, wow, he took it right, he took that missile right through the window, he gave someone a corn chip, like, this is unbelievable, the whole building collapsed. If you could watch that and enjoy it, that's ASAP. Right? That's that. If you watch a boxing match, And watch some guy's head get snapped back, and the sweat is flying off, and he hit him again. And the mouthpiece comes out, and you're like, wow, you know, give me some. That's not an ohev shalom, right? If a person sees that, and again, it's not. This is all part of our. You watch a football game. There's the athleticism, right? Which is fine so far, but there's the impact. Right? If you're looking to see the hit. Right. I'm looking to see the hit. I want to see a helmet go flying. Right? That means it's the best part, right? Yes. Ohev shalom v'rodedo. Somehow Aaron Cohen, there's a big rub, came from Europe to the United States. He came after the war, after being chased through the mirrors at the Mir Yeshiva in Shanghai. And he went through, he's actually a Rosh Yeshiva in the Philadelphia Yeshiva, a Mendel Kaplan, my Zadie's brother. He's a Yeshiva in the Philadelphia Yeshiva. Right, so he came to the United States, and a major Talmud Chacham, and here's this European rub, and he says, everybody's crazy about television. Finally, one day, he says, okay, let's see what's on TV. So to his great, like, there was a boxing match on TV. Mm-hmm. Right, there's a boxing match on TV. So he's watching, the guy's down, the guy's hitting him, the guy's like, he saw, he's hitting him, finally he's just looking, and he goes, Nochazet? Nochazet? He's hitting him again? I can even look at it, if that's what interests you, if that's what interests you, that means that I'm talking to myself because we've all got this in us. If you want to see that, that's not an ohev shalom. The first way to make peace among people is that I genuinely have to love peace. The idea of quarreling, the idea of bickering, the idea of somebody yelling at the gabbai turns my stomach. If I'm really excited by it because it breaks the monotony of life, then I'm not an ohev shalom. That's number one. Then I'm not an ohev shalom. We went to, I was watching a football game with my dad once. The Bears were playing, of course, Philadelphia. And what do you call it? Ron Jaworski was the quarterback. And there's a guy in the Bears named Hartenstein. Big. No. They don't make you this size, right? I only know one. And he was, what do you call it? I think it was Mike Hartenstein. And we're watching the game. Jaworski goes back. Hartenstein beat his man clean. They missed somebody, did not block him at all. Jaworski is in there. He's looking out in the right flat like this. He's looking for somebody. And Hartenstein is coming in from the blind spot. Jaworski never saw him. I just remember my dad and I, because we're sitting there looking like this. Also, we both went, whoa, like that. They watched it heavy. Hartenstein, in fact, one thing is clear. Jaworski was unconscious before he hit the ground. That was clear. he did not know what. Jaworski was unconscious. The ball went flying one way, his head went flying the other way, right? He was on a different planet, clearly on a different planet. I just remember it happened. We were horrified because you saw it was going to happen. There was no penalty. And they even asked Hartenstein afterwards, you know, what happened? It was a clean hit. I just hit him with my face. It just obliterated. And he's sitting here, like, whoa! If you enjoy that sort of thing, the person has to say, you know, I don't know if the Chafetz Chaim would be so pleased. That's what you have to be an ohev shalom. It should be absolutely daunting. That's what a person. Then, if the idea, and that's only on violence. Conflict is the same way. You see two people bickering, you have to get to the point where the bickering is absolutely repulsive to you. If he excites you to see conflict, if somebody's getting at, go tell him. Somebody's pegging somebody on, that's not an ohev shalom. The first rule in became making peace among other people is to be ohev shalom. I want to say something else. People cannot tolerate inconsistencies, right? There's always somebody in the house, usually the father, who, if you ever get upset, you ever get angry, if I, come on, everybody, just calm down. Nobody get angry. Yeah. When he gets angry, that's okay. He can go, nobody can calm him down. But if you get angry, nobody wants to hear him say, okay, everybody, just calm down. Calm. We're not just the Utahs to calm down, because when you're angry, so you don't find it so easy to calm down. We don't like it. If the Chafetz Chaim would come in and say, everybody, calm down, then you're able to calm down. Father, because if somebody else is not practicing it, nobody wants to hear it. If you expect to make peace between people, the people see you as a conflicting, as a what's the word? Personality. You are always involved in conflict. What's the word?
Protagonist
is exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah. If people see you as a confrontational personality, and all of a sudden you're stopping other people from confronting, nobody wants to hear that. Nobody's interested in hearing your mussar if you're not practicing it. So the first rule is always tell brother yourself. Now, the next one is, oivis abrios, or mekarban latorah. You got to love people and bring close to Torah. Now, the first idea here is that if you really love people, what's the best thing you can do for them? To bring them near to Torah. Because a guy who is missing Torah, so he's missing all the good of Torah, he's missing a Torah lifestyle, missing Torah learning. So if you really love somebody, you want what's best for it. So that's the best thing you can do. Best thing you can do is to bring people close to Torah. There's only one problem. To bring people close to Torah is not necessarily to preach to them to come close to Torah. Right? Yes, you want to bring them close to Torah. The question is always, how do you bring people close to Torah? Because often the best way to bring people close to Torah is by not trying. Sometimes the harder you try to bring people close to Torah, the less people are going to come close to Torah because they sense that you're trying too hard. That's why if you ever want to be Makar of your parents, when you go back from Israel, you want to impress your parents with your religion and everything else, the only way to do it is by doing anything but Torah. The worst thing to do is to start preaching about how your father has to wash his hands 3 times in the morning or he'll be chased by evil spirits. That's not going to be Makar of anybody. The best way to be Makar of your parents is going to be to go home and to do the dishes. That's the best way to do it. Or to stand up for your father when he walks in the room. If you genuinely, that's idea number one. Idea number one is that you have to show them the compassion that you would show because you love people. When you do that, we see over and over again that people who are Makar to Torah, it's a result of people who they experience sensitivity from. People are not Makar by people who preached at them. There's a kid in Eretz Yisrael who said, he became Baal Tshuva, he was about 25 years old, became Baal Tshuva. They asked him how he became Baal Tshuva. He said, he said when he was about 15, he was living in Tel Aviv, and he used to walk to school every morning in Tel Aviv, completely secular. Every morning he'd be walking to school, and there are hundreds of people on the streets of Tel Aviv. No one ever said a word to him. There's one little old guy with a beard, a firm guy, who was on his way home from shul every morning, and he was carrying a talus bag. Every morning on the way home from shul, he saw the kid on the street who just smiled and said good morning to him as he walked past. The kid said he finished, you know, he was secular, went to the army, after the army, went traveling around the world, and eventually began his search for truth and meaning. And he realized that there's only one person in the world who ever smiled at him was this firm guy with a talus bag. He somehow made an association with the talus bag, that's what made him from. But at the end of the day, what's going to appeal to people is how they see you relating to them as a human being, not as a religious object. And if you come to people, they sense you're worried about their neshama, people don't respond to that well. But if they see you care about them as a human being, that effect. There's another story about a guy who was a conductor on the Tel Aviv Yerushalayim line. Some firm guy got off the train, and he started walking off up to the front of the train. What's it called? Where the guy did the caboose, right? To the front of the train, right? And he starts walking up there, and his friend said to him, what's it called? Is that what it's called? Right? So he goes walking up there, and his friend says to him, where are you going? He says, just 1 second. He walks over to the conductor. He says, thanks for the ride. Right? Conductor said, in 30 years of driving the train, no one has ever taken the trouble to come up there and say thank you. Not like a bus where you get up and you know the guy standing all the way up there. So it's being perfect because of that. Right? You find over and over. The key is, always with the bridge, you got to genuinely love them. You got to genuinely like the people. And I'll tell you a secret. When you are trying to work on your relatives and you want to influence your relatives, that expression right there is a problem. As soon as you say, I'm trying to work on him, then you're in trouble. You have to genuinely not try to work on him. You have to genuinely try to do for him. Rabbi Gottlieb has an interesting exercise. I learned this from him years ago. Very interesting. Imagine it's your father's birthday. Your brother's birthday. What would you get your brother for a birthday gift?
Nothing.
Don't laugh. Nine out of ten Baal Tshuva surveyed. Right, you know, what would you buy your father for? What would you buy your father for Father's Day? You know, a mezuzah holder. A new machzer. You know, never too late to be Cuba, right? You know, a vidui on the deathbed with, you know, printed in English, you know, with flowers around the side, these are what people, it's the most ridiculous thing in the world. You know, well, get him Rabbi Gottlieb's book, get him Rabbi Katz's book, get him a philosophy book. How would you like it if it was your birthday and your brother got you, your brother who's a Chinese art exchange student, right, sent you a big book on Chinese art, right? Wow, pagodan structure from the 12th century. You know, wow, just what I've always wondered about and been interested in. You wouldn't. You'd resent it. You know, that's what you're interested in, what I'm interested in. You have to understand where your parents, where people are coming from. If you really want to be Makar people, your father's birthday, buy him some golf clubs. That's what you should buy your father's birthday. If your brother's birthday, buy him a free, what do you call it? He's got a free beer takeout, what do you call it? A coupon for free beers every weekend for a year. Right? The best thing you can get if you expect to see him in Yeshiva. Right? If they sense that you're worried about their soul, who asked you to preach to us? If you care about me as a person, that means you yourself have become a better person. You yourself have changed. And if you've changed, then it's worth investigating that change. That's what we've seen over and over in the course of the year. So the Mishnah, the Musar from Aaron is that if you really want to affect people, you have to genuinely care about them as people. And don't do it with, in the back of your mind, see how much I care about you? No. Don't you want to put on Tefillin? Don't do it. Then you blow the whole thing. Right? Don't say a word about Tefillin. If you're going for a visit, don't say a word about Tefillin. Not when you get, and on the way back to the airplane, as they're driving to the airport, and by the way, I was pretty nice, wasn't I? What about him as a dad? The whole thing is gone. One line, you throw out the whole thing.
But what is the first mitzvah like someone should usually take on?
The first mitzvah someone should take on, or the first time you try to get everybody else to take on?
Alright, if someone wants to start, what mitzvah should they first take on?
If someone wants to start, you start with four mitzvahs. There are four mitzvahs you start with. You start with Shabbos observance, kashrus, fill-in if you're married, tarsim, shvachah. Those are the four mitzvahs.
Pretty big. That's a lot.
Bigger than you could imagine, right? But nobody knows that when you tell them. There's only four of those, four little mitzvahs, you know. So it finds out what they are, you know, four little mitzvahs, find out what they are. Oh, Shabbos, yeah, no problem. You mean chomp? That's the one. Okay, great. Next thing you know, the guys find out, no, don't touch that. Don't say, mitzvah. Sorry, you said you committed it. Right.
No, I mean, like,
you
should know. Washing or
smiling. No. You start with Shabbos and kashrus. And you know, even kashrus nowadays, you got to keep it in proper perspective. Kashrus is not that difficult. Kashrus is not that difficult. The last time I saw it, there was a study. There were over 50,000. Then there was another study, even more. But the last I saw, one day there were over 50,000 products in the American market that have kashrus supervision. Over 50,000 products in the American market have kashrus supervision, and some of them are actually kosher. Right? You know, over 50,000 products. In any city in the world now, you could get kosher bread. You can certainly get kosher candy bars, meat. And as I say, kashrus is not a big deal. If you want to be obstinate, because you got to eat swordfish, so there's nothing we can do for you. And even that we're working on, because we got kosher style bacon now. There's kosher style bacon now, and you can have a cheeseburger two ways now. You have kosher cheeseburger. You can have kosher shrimp. Listen, we're finally living, right? You can have a cheeseburger too. You could have dairy meat. You could have dairy cheese with parva meat, and you could have parva cheese with real meat, right? You have a cheeseburger. We're finally, we made it. Right? There are no excuses for kashrus. There are no excuses for kashrus. Shabbos, what's the big deal? You sit and eat, you get to eat and sleep so you can't drive your car for 24 hours. That's the end of the world. And if you really got to watch TV, because you're such a deep person, if you really got to watch TV, by the letter of law, you can leave the TV on from the beginning of the Shabbos. That's why I put it on a timer. I know a guy came from home, who went off. He told me he and his friends also went off. They used to sit on Shabbos and watch TV, and they would want to change the channels. They would throw shoes at the TV so they should be on the shinui, so they should be the rabbanon, right? So the guy, it should be Mr. Drive. So he himself used to get up and turn. He said he could take the Hakapa Akasri. He did it straight. And he's wrong, by the way. He still should minimize it to the rabbanon. He's wrong. You shouldn't throw the shoes at it. You got to do it, throw shoes at it. Right? But don't do it. Don't watch TV and Shabbos. But if you're absolutely, so that's also doable. For a guy in the beginning stage who says, yeah, but what am I going to do about TV? Leave your TV on. Leave your TV on. Rabbi Strauss Salanter told the guys in Hummel, when he was trying to get people to close their businesses, the guy says, yeah, I can't close my business all the time. He says, do you have to write? He says, no, I don't have to write. He says, don't write. So minimize what you can minimize. That's what you start with. The guy says, yeah, but I'm going to go to work Saturday morning. Okay, but Shabbos night, you have a deal. You have a meal Friday night. And don't do them all on Friday night. Start somewhere. Those are the ones you want to start with. Those are the big ones. Okay, 548. Who are you, Omer? Mishnah Yud Dalet. Skip the Mishnah Yud Dalet. Who are you, Omer? He used to say the following: Im ein ani li mili. If I am not for myself, who can be? Who will be for me? Ukishe ani la atmi moani. When I am for myself, what am I? V'im lo achshav v'masay. If not now, when? Who are you, Omer? If I'm not for myself, who will be for me? That means that you have a goal, you have a job in life. Adam la'amal yulad. Man was created to toil. You have a job to do. If you don't do your job, nobody else can do the job for you. The same way that nobody can eat lunch for you. You would never expect somebody to eat lunch for you. You can't have somebody. You've got, every single human being is unique. Every single human being has potential. Every single human being has talents. And you've got a job because your worker has expectations of you. If you don't do the job, nobody can do the job for you. In Einan Lili Mili, who can do it for me? Nobody can do the job for you. You've got the responsibility to do the job. Ufshani La'atzvi, on the other hand, when you do for yourself, be careful. Mani, what have I really achieved? You say, be careful not to start patting yourself on the back because I started going to Minyan or I started learning a little bit. That's great. But who said that's it? Right? When I do what I'm money, what am I compared to what I could? We always underestimate our potential. We always underestimate our spiritual potential. If a person felt the urgency in the world of Ruchnius, the same way they feel the urgency in the world of Gashmius, we could achieve a tremendous amount. Right? A person feels that they've got a job to do and they've got sufficient motivation. We started talking, spoke about that this morning, then a person could achieve a tremendous amount. Ukshani lasmi, what I need? Mani. Now, be careful, because we live in the age, we live in the world of low self-esteem. Right? This is a very 20th century malady. Like low self-esteem. You see, in the shtetl in Europe, that was never a problem. Low self-esteem was never a problem in the shtetl in Europe. Because the shtetl in Europe, you're just trying to find shoes for your children, and you were busy running away from Cossacks chasing you through the forest, right? You didn't have time to say, no husband ever came up to, Edna, I think I got low self-esteem. Listen, Herschel, Yankee still doesn't have shoes and he's 9 years old, and I understand that Igor the Cossack is, there's supposed to be a, a pogrom anytime this week. Do you think we could board up the windows, all right, but I'm not going to do as good a job as Beryl next door. He's got low self-esteem. They never had a Their self-esteem was never an issue. Once people become affluent, I remember I said last that suicide is much more prevalent among the wealthy than among the poor. And there's a very good reason for it. The poor don't have time to commit suicide. They got to go to work. Right? We need to burn out. I can't commit suicide. I got to put bread out. The poor rich people got plenty of time on their hands, so they can get involved in realizing how miserable they are. Right? Well, the poor people can't think about it. They've got their luxuries. They can't commit suicide. Right. We all got low self-esteem. So because we got low self-esteem, you got to be careful not to be too harsh on yourself. Because then you start doing mitzvahs, you say, but I'm still a crumb and I'm going to burn anyway. I'm never going to get anything with this. So you stop doing mitzvahs. Right? So as I say, when you are achieving, how much is it compared to what you should? On the other hand, be happy that you're achieving. At the end of the day, you should be happy. Pat yourself on the back. I've done mitzvahs. I did make it to Minyan. I do keep Shabbos. These are major achievements. Never forget it. Just always remember that there's more that could be accomplished. That's critical. And the last one is the Noach Shavei Mazal. If not now, when? Our motto in high school was, don't do today that which you could put off till tomorrow. Right? That was our motto. Right? There are others who have a motto, if you're hungry, it's kosher. That was the motto of some. Our motto was don't do today that which we could be put off until tomorrow, right? The Mishnah's motto is the opposite. People got, should I take off a year to go learn in Yeshiva? Well, first I'll finish college, then I'll do it. No, you won't. You don't do it right now. The opportunity comes up, you don't know. And Mishnah's have a way of escaping you all the time. If you don't do it right now, when are you going? Imlo achshav imosai. I want to ask you something. Tomorrow morning, right after Nates. Anytime after Nates. Nates tomorrow morning is about 5:30. Anytime after 5:30 tomorrow morning, there's going to be an envelope in this room with every one of your names on it and a $100 bill in the envelope. You can come in anytime tomorrow after 5:30 to pick up the envelope. Anytime tomorrow morning after 5:30, come in here, pick up an envelope with your name and $100 in the envelope. What's that mean to be here, Josh? I'm not going to get sleep. I'm going to take a chance, just in case you sleep 24 hours. Remember, you only got till sunset. All right, tell me, I'm going to go to sleep. And if you do go to sleep, there could be a big line out that door. What time? Why? Because you're worried. You may lose your MMO. If I don't get it now, when am I going to get it? What if I miss the opportunity? Exactly what the attitude should be when it comes to our business. If I don't do it, something people put up. I got to daven mincha. I'll daven mincha later. I'll daven shabbos later. Right? Then we know what happens. Right? And all of a sudden, I think I got to daven two shmonesh rays. I forgot mincha. And something by the end of the week, I think I got to daven 14 shmonesh rays. haven't been Larry in a while. Yeah, he's still davening shmonesh rays. Yeah. It's been a long one. He's got this 6-hour job today. Making up all of the week's shmonesh rays. And at the end of the day, you can't, first of all, you can't. Second of all, at the end of the day, Mrs. have a way of getting it. Mrs. Sun kind of like, listen, you lost it from outside. If you're going to make money, you do it right now. You never put up making money. Right? When it comes to doing Torah Mrs., you made her do it now, because if you don't, you'll find these things a way of escaping. And it's particularly true when you're young, and you think that you've got time when you're young to sit and learn, that sort of thing. You got the opportunity to do it now. Because later on in life, you are inundated with responsibilities. When the responsibilities start coming in, and your time does not belong to you. By the time once you get married, you realize that you have ceased to exist, right? You have no independent time of your own. I asked a guy once, you guys married 3 months. I said, what have you learned in your first 3 months of marriage? The guy said to me, don't make any independent plans. Right? And it's true. And then when kids come along, then you have like less time. And if you don't take the opportunity, as soon as the opportunity comes up, experience shows that everything escapes. Okay.